But and Ola couldn't see them. He couldn't see them. He said that eventually, no question down about it, that the right wing will throw out the dissident elements called the militants. The militants. As Kansas City couldn't understand why they called themselves that. But that's what they call themselves. And we'll analyze them in a few minutes. Ola also, by this time, started to develop the concept in 1935 that it was a matter of principle that under no condition does the Revolutionary Party take its banner and pull down its banner and surrender to another enemy organization. And the answer was that he was correct, 100%. The only thing is that that Trotskyism in the United States is not a political party. It's only a small propaganda group. Secondly, it was explained to him that we weren't going into the Socialist Party to become disciples of Norman Thomas, or Hillman, or Dubinsky, or Hillquist. That we were going in to perform a political task. As I said before, the workers weren't coming into the Trotskyist movement in this country because these two big obstacles were blocking our road. They couldn't see us because they saw the Communist Party and they saw the Socialist Party. And the question comes down, as Cannon has repeatedly said time and time again, the important thing about politics is to know what to do next. You can have the correct program, all the correct programs from here to hell. You can have the best propagandists in the world, putting out good newspapers, magazines, participate in all kinds of actions. But if you don't know what to do next, you might just as well retire and quit. And that was what the American Trotskyist movement had come to that stage. What to do next? Exist as a small, nice, pure, and holy organization that wasn't going to dirty its hands by mixing with these dirty old socialists? Or would they go into this organization and become a left wing in it, break down the organizational barriers between the ranks of the Socialist Party and Trotskyism, and unite with them, and sooner or later lay down the gauntlet to the right wingers? That was the question. Now, Ola couldn't see that, and he raised hell inside the Trotskyist movement, and it culminated in July of 1935. Yeah, in 1935, where the question for the first time was discussed at a plenum of the Workers' Party. And it was at this time that a caucus was organized by the Cannon-Shachtman grouping, who were for entrance into the Socialist Party if conditions warranted it. They weren't for entrance into the Socialist Party, by no means, not at that time. It was a question of keeping an eye on the Socialist Party, and if conditions did warrant it, we should enter it. And that's how that resolution that was adopted at that time, or wasn't adopted, but that was the way the resolution of the Cannon-Shachtman group was written. Ola, on the other hand, said it was a matter of principle. As I said last week, he repeated until he was blue in the face the fact that Rosa Luxemburg had said the Second International was a stinking corpse in 1940. Now, under the impact of world events, this grouping inside the Socialist Party, called the militants, started to talk really radical. They were led by a pack of schoolboys in their 30s. Young fellows and girls who would get out of school, got their sheepskin, and joined the ranks of the unemployed with any jobs for anybody in the 30s, for the love of Pete. And the first thing you know, these people were talking against people's frontism. That's a good sign. They were talking for the dictatorship of the proletariat. They were against the Second International, but not for the Fourth. They were against the Second International. And they were looking for a revolutionary road. Well, what do you do in such a case? Do you say to them, look, I'm the guy that you should unite with. Why don't you quit the Socialist Party and join me? They say, well, who's that guy that's talking like that? They couldn't even see us. We were so small. And that's what they told us. They said, well, you people you don't amount to anything. And lots of them said, well, Trotsky's right. Oh, sure, Trotsky's right. Every dope knows that, for Christ's sake. But you guys aren't accomplishing anything. You're isolated. Why don't you join the party? The party meant the social party. That's what the hell they felt in those days. And after the settling of the accounts with the Olerites in November of 1935, where they frequently broke discipline by distributing, they demanded a paper of their own. Of course, every faction does that when they're ready to quit. They started to distribute their propaganda at public meetings of the Trotskyists. And in the celebration of the first anniversary of the founding of the Workers' Party, they distributed thick bulletins explaining how Trotsky was selling out. Cannon is just an errand boy for Trotsky, he's selling out, and so forth and so on, and warning the American Trotskyists of how they were going to be led by Norman Thomas if they didn't watch their step. Well, Trotsky, Oler and his gang were expelled at that time. They took probably a third of the organization. It's safe to say that 75% of the elements that Oler took were workers, not petty bourgeois elements, they were workers. And that's one thing we have to get into our head, that it isn't just the petty bourgeois elements that revolt against the program of the party, that the workers revolt too. The workers aren't the same today as they were 10 years ago. The workers are joining the party. And they're influenced and pushed around by class pressures. And the result was that Oler took about a third of the organization, mainly trade unionists, the few trade union contacts that the American Trotskyist movement had outside of the Minneapolis and Toledo comrades. To make it short and sweet, Olerism took the entire Detroit branch of the Trotskyist movement, 100%. They were in on the ground floor in the great groundswell that created the United Automobile Workers in 1936-37. But they carried their sectarianism right into the trade union movement. This idea of fighting for a quarter raise, the hell with that. We should get a dollar raise. Instead of yelling for a paid vacation, we should get a month's vacation. And all these ridiculous demands, and it finally ended with them being driven out of the leadership of the local unions that they founded and led in the city of Detroit. You comrades read a notice in our paper here about a month ago, an obituary to a man named Saul. I remember him when he was thrown down the stairs and out of the union that he was the president of in Detroit. His ultra-radicalism had so infuriated the rank and file of his union and gave the right-wingers so much ammunition that they could use physical force against him and his comrades and throw them bodily out of the damn union that they had founded and led. That's the sickness of sectarianism. And eventually, Olerism went through the typical splits that take part in all these sectarian organizations that have split off from the Fourth International, one after the other. They had one split after the other. They ended up gone with the wind. They don't exist today, of course. But in order to carry out this line of going into the Socialist Party meant another factional struggle inside the Trotskyist movement. Now that Oler was gone, the groundwork was laid for some kind of a political discussion and political understanding of what was our task next. The party had got rid of the sectarians because it was absolutely necessary. It was necessary to have a split. It was progressive. Why was it progressive? See, as Cannon says, splits and unities are necessary for the development of the revolutionary movement. We had to have a split at this time, because how could we enter the Socialist Party if we had, say, one-third or one-fourth of the members going into the Socialist Party, carrying on a whispering campaign, Norman Thomas is a faker. You're talking with some workers and socialist workers that work in your factory, now your comrades are theirs. You're no longer, the organizational barrier has been smashed, and now you're comrades of these members in the Socialist Party who work in the same factory with you. How could you make any progress there if there was some screwball saying, what the hell are you fooling around those monkeys? What are they're Norman Thomas followers, for Christ's sake. You couldn't do any work. How could you do any work if when Norman Thomas ran for president in 1936? We were the main driving force in that political campaign. What could you do if you had all around saying, what the hell are you nominating? What are you breaking your back waiting, trying to get votes out for that jerk? Don't you know he's a reformist? Whisper to you, a reformist. No kidding. In other words, you had to get rid of Orrism before you could do any effective work inside the Socialist Party. And that was accomplished by them being thrown out and expelled in November 1935. But that didn't clear up the problem. By this time, Musty conceived of the idea that the Workers' Party was a permanent creation. And he developed a fixation that we shouldn't dissolve the Workers' Party. Yeah, it's very important to fool around with the Socialist Party, but he couldn't bring himself to make that next step, to liquidate the organization and enter as a body into the Socialist Party. And he was prompted, you might say, as well as urged on into this position by a grouping inside the party that was not a faction, but a clique. Now, there's a difference between a faction and a clique. A faction marches under a program and fights openly for that program. But this grouping, led by a man named Martin Ahern, one of the founders of American Trotskyism, carried on its campaign on a clique basis, never had any political program, never in all its existence from the early 1930s until it was went with Shachtman in 1940, never had any political program of any nature whatsoever. They had only one concept in their ideology, if you want to call it that, they call it an ideology. And that was, Cannon's a bastard. That's all. Cannon is a bastard. And how was he a bastard? Well, anybody in this world knows that the members of our pals, we'll say, instead of saying our clique, that our pals are the most talented people in the world. If you don't believe me, ask Joe. I say he's the most brilliant man in the world, and he says I'm the most brilliant man in the world. That was about their proof of their brilliance. It's a fantastic thing. I was thinking about coming over to the meeting today. These people were utterly incompetent. They didn't have any talents whatsoever. And no talent, none of them, none of them. Abraham himself was no speaker. He was no organizer. He was no writer. And he was no inspirer of an individual in a personal conversation. And you go down the whole goddamn list of them. There were a large section, the main core of them were petty bourgeois elements that for some peculiar reason thought they did have talents, but they had no talents whatsoever. And they believed that Cannon was their main obstacle to them displaying their fine feathers, I guess they call it. And this grouping was held together through internal gossip. The political committee could meet, as you know, in democratic centralism, the top leadership of the party, elected by convention, has the responsibility of running the party. And that top committee of the party is under the discipline of the committee itself. And what goes on in the committee is nobody's business. No one's business. That's the centralist side of Leninism. Well, in these, Ahern was always on the political committee of the Trotskyist movement. As Cannon said, he made no contribution whatsoever. He was accepted by the rest of the members of the political committee as a lightweight, but he was put on there with the idea of keeping an eye on him. Whenever you're in such a situation as that, it's always good organizational procedure to put him or her on the committee so you can watch them. And if you watch them close enough, you can tell what they're going to do tomorrow. Now this gang was held together. It was a national grouping. It was held together by Ahern distributing throughout the grouping, all over the country, all the inside dope on what was going on in the political committee. It sounds fantastic, but that I have the document up the house that documents the development of the Ahern clique, sending letters morning, noon, and night. That's one thing they did. They were very capable letter writers. And there's no doubt about it that there was something wrong with them mentally. Because in these letters they talk about I. Lucky I was there, I saved the situation. the national office is an awful jam, and it's only for me that the Trotskyist movement is being saved in this country. Those are the kind of letters that Abram wrote. Out of this world. But this grouping was held together by this gossip. And the fact that Cannon was the main obstacle against Marty Abram, proving to the whole entire world and forever, to posterity forever, that he was a far superior person, even, I guess, than Karl Marx himself. He was a fool. Well, they shimmied up to Musty and poisoned them and explained how Cannon was trying to wiggle us into the Socialist Party without anybody knowing it. Now, Abram and his group were not opposed to the French turn. They never took positions on any political question. They weren't opposed. They kept their ear to the ground to find out what Trotsky was thinking, and then they would propose to propound Trotsky's theories and his ideas. Now, they were for the French turn, for entrance into the Socialist Party under given conditions and so forth. And they entered into a bloc with Musty, who was opposed to going into the Socialist Party, completely unprincipled. One is for and one is against. But that was only a minor detail as far as Abram was concerned. The main thing was that this grouping was opposed to Cannon, and that was all they were interested in. Now, during this period of time, one of Musty's strongholds was in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where we had a branch of about 40 members. And there were all kinds of queer going-ons down there, particularly in the unemployed movement, where our comrades, where the branch was split in half, of course, because of the carrying-ons. Half of them supporting the line laid down by the political committee, and the other half following some kind of a strange line that was very partial to Stalinism, because the Stalinists had a big unemployed organization too, but not in Allentown. And over a period of weeks and months, the reports kept getting back into New York that the Stalinists were penetrating, their influence was penetrating the Allentown branch. And Cannon and his supporters tried to call a halt to this through the political committee. But Musty always stood against it. He stood in between. That is, in between settling accounts with the Allentown pro-Stalinist wing of the branch down there, and the Trotskyists led by Cannon. On the basis that they have to learn through experience, and a lot of it is just plain gossip and exaggerations and so forth and so on. Musty was supporting his friends, in other words, down in Allentown. He was supporting them against the correct line of the Trotskyist movement and indirectly supporting enemies of the Workers' Party. This, of course, is completely unprincipled, and it was an unprincipled politics based on subjectivism, on the attempt to fight Cannon, whom he suspected of wanting to liquidate the Workers' Party into the Socialist Party. And he was supported in this treachery by Abram. And lo and behold, this whole thing came to a head at the convention of the Trotskyists in April of 1936, where we made a decision to join the Socialist Party. Cannon and Shachtman had carried on a struggle of preparing the ranks of the party to enter the Socialist Party if conditions warranted it. And conditions started to warm up in December of 1935 when Hillquit, that is the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, Dubinsky, that is the International Lady Garment Workers, decided to cut out all this phony playing around with socialism and getting down to business and becoming statesmen in the Democratic Party. So they quit the Socialist Party when they found out that the militants had control of the New York organization. Well, now the Socialist Party was an entirely different setup. It might have been necessary for the Trotskyists to enter even if Hillman and them had remained. But now that they were out of the way, it meant that the militants had a complete free hand inside the Socialist Party. The reactionary elements had walked out of the party. The Jewish Bund which was the backbone of reaction inside the Socialist Party, walked out of the Socialist Party and left it to these young, inexperienced elements that for some reason or other thought that they were leaders and socialists. Well, when this happened, Tannen and Schachman immediately oriented towards the Socialist Party entrance. And they did it by introducing a resolution into the political committee of the party, calling a meeting of the national committee to discuss the question, and from there proceeding to a national convention which okayed the entrance into the Socialist Party. Now at this convention, I'll never forget it, the first day it was called to order, the Daily Worker came out with the announcement that three prominent Trotskyists, Johnson, you know that dope Arnold Johnson, ex-Sky pilot, a man named Halleck and another named Reich from Allentown, had quit the Trotskyist movement and joined the Stalinist Party. This was a terrific blow to Musty, because he had been warned and warned and warned that Stalinism was penetrating into the Allentown branch and that some of his friends were preparing to betray the party and join the Communist Party. And it was a terrific lesson, of course, in unprincipled politics. And cliqueism, propounded by Abramism, which was also peddled to Musty, that a good clique, a good personal friendship business, is much better than building a revolutionary party based on principles, political principles. Now when the militants took over the control of the Socialist Party, they issued a big manifesto signed by Norman Thomas, you know, that old hardened revolutionary. And they explained how these political fakers had left the Socialist Party, and now they were going to build the revolutionary party in the United States, and we urge all serious workers and intellectuals to come and join the Socialist Party and help us build this party. Well, the Trotsky guy said, hey, that sounds pretty good. We'll be over to see you tomorrow. And that's exactly what happened. This terrified them. They, in their exuberance over these right-wingers walking out, they had overreached themselves by issuing such a welcome. And they never expected the Trotskyists to say, yeah, well, we'll be over there tomorrow morning. So they said, oh, wait a second. They wouldn't allow us to join as an organization. We had to join as individuals. There was no welcoming to us. They didn't put it in their paper that the Trotskyists were going to liquidate and join them in building the Revolutionary Party. Nothing at all. There was no publicity whatsoever. And above everything else, there was no post at all. No post at all for any of the Trotskyists joining the Socialist Party. Imagine a man like Cannon, not even given a post, not to mention other comrades, but no post whatsoever. The comrades from Minneapolis that had just engaged in a great trade union struggle, never even recognized. That's how contemptuous and how frightened, that's what it was, how frightened these individuals were who were the so-called leaders of the militants. They wanted us because they knew that we could take care of the Stalinists who were putting the pressure on them to liquidate and join the Communist Party. They knew we had all the answers. So they welcomed us on that basis. Well, what was the Socialist Party like? When we joined it, we found out that it was a hollow shell. A hollow shell. They had all kinds of great pretensions. State organizations, you know, and so forth. In Massachusetts, they had a couple of thousand members. Well, if you were Jesus Christ, you wouldn't have been able to find them. They had 600 youth members. Members of the Young Socialist, Young People's Socialist League. You know what these 600 were? They were members of the Finnish Federation up in Gardner, Mass. They knew no more about socialism than the man on the moon. But this was the hangover of the old federations, these foreign federations that were brought over from the old country by the Finnish workers, the Jewish workers, the Slavic workers of all the different nationalities and so forth. Belgian Federation, all these federations existed throughout the United States, which was a reflection of the immigration that poured into the United States. So up there, they had 600 members in the youth. Well, in Boston, they had probably a dozen. And another dozen, nine of them didn't know why they were in the Socialist Party. So you could would take an example, these young socialists, our comrades, who were the young socialists grouping in the city here, in the state. They could carry all their work they wanted and do all the constructive work of building the Socialist Party. But when it came to really setting up the state organization, in came one of these young ward healers from Pittsburgh and said, here's my 600 votes. They voted in a block. They didn't vote individually. He said, yeah, I represent 600 votes, and I guess I'll be the secretary this coming term. And Hamo Tamo, you know these names the Finns have, he'll be the organizational secretary. Well, who's he? Oh, he belongs up in Gavin. Oh, we never see him. Oh, he doesn't come. Well, that's the way the organization was. Well, that's where a picture of it throughout the whole country. Except in some of the big industrial centers, the Socialist Party had membership. The Automobile Workers Union, the Steel Union, on the waterfront even, and so on. And in no time, these workers came to our ideology, as well as to our comradeship, you might say. Now, when we entered the Socialist Party, there was a line laid down on how to proceed. Don't go into the Socialist Party, and in Massachusetts here, a very poor man was a secretary, Alfred Baker Lewis, poor bastard, only had $10-20 million. He used the Socialist Party as an organization to run around, fool around with girls. And he had illegitimate kids all over the state, and in Rhode Island, too. Well, we were told, don't go in there, and when this guy puts out his hand, how are you, comrades? Oh, for Christ's sake, get away. No, you weren't interested in Alfred Baker Lewis. We were interested in some of the rank and file of his organization. That's what we were interested in. So we shook hands with Alfred. How are you, Comrade Baker? Then afterwards, you wiped your hands. But that's where you play the game. He put me on his payroll at $10 a week to do organizational work down in Lynn. And some of these other guys, though, the old socialists, they were bleeding them for $40 and $50 a week as organizers. Christ, he didn't give money, meant nothing to him, of course. Well, that's what we entered on a friendly basis to the rank and file, as well as to the leadership. We were going in there to do a political job. That's what we were going in for, not to show how smart we were, or that we were super Bolsheviks or anything of that nature. No attacks on the leadership. Work with the rank and file, that's what we were told to do. And become the best members of the Socialist Party. Now just think of that, become the best members of the Socialist Party. What did that mean? The best bootlickers for Norman Thomas? Of course not. Prove to the rank and file that you're interested in, that you want to build a Socialist Party because this is their party. And after they see that you're really plugging and you're doing your bit, then you can talk to them because you've broken down the organizational barrier and you have their confidence. We didn't go into the Socialist Party. I remember Don and Lynn there. We didn't go in there and say, what was that you said? Caballero is the Lenin of Spain? But crazy, he's a phony, the $4 bill. No, we didn't say that. We just said, yeah, I guess so. The hell, we don't look for an argument. We said to ourselves, we've settled with you about 6 months from now, brother. That's exactly what we did. We ran the election campaign for Norman for the Socialist Party in that Middlesex County, is it where they belong? That's the county. We ran the public meeting for Norman Thomas and so forth. We were the socialists. There was only about 40 of us in the state, not even that. But we were the Socialist Party in the state here. And we proved to the rank and file elements, there were only a couple dozen of them, we proved to them that we meant business and we weren't in your party to split it. And the result was that when we did get thrown out, they came with us because they saw that we knew what we were doing and that we had entered the party in good faith, whereas these militants had double-crossed us. And we'll explain that. Now, side by side with this, even with the, it shows you how the working class and socialists in general are affected by international events. Oh, the Spanish Civil War wasn't more than 6 months old. wasn't more than 6 months old, when an experienced Marxist could say, it's hopeless. It's a terrible goddamn thing. These workers are just fighting for nothing. The Stalinists took over the revolution, which meant they were going to crush it, but it's clear today, of course. You comrades can say, oh, sure, hell, anybody know the Stalinists would do that. But not in 1936. Don't forget, Stalinism was only feeling its oats.